Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, and this is the Offbeat Oregon History Podcast, which every weekday brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History syndicated newspaper column. Well, today is Thursday, so I have another installment in our Stories, Legends, and Lies of Oregon series. This is the series that showcases great stories from early Oregon memoir writers and storytellers, along with more than a few tall tale tellers and truth stretchers, and even some straight-up liars. Yes, we have those. Well, thank you for loading me down and queuing me up today, and I hope you enjoy the show. This particular one is the story of a legendary 1800s circus man who's talking about Big Top life. It's actually one of the Works Progress Administration interviews that was done in the late 1930s in Portland. At the age of 91, Doc Van Alstyne was a living legend among circus people when he gave this interview. He recalls a lifetime of traveling and performing with train wrecks and dangerous animals and the occasional tornado, too. It starts off with an editor's note. Of course, the editor is me. Over four afternoons in July of 1938, Works Progress Administration writer A.C. Sherbert interviewed a 91-year-old circus legend, W.E. Doc Van Alstyne. The interviews took place in Doc's room at the Jefferson Hotel, situated at the corner of 1st and Jefferson in downtown Portland. The old gentleman was primarily on Social Security, so this wasn't a fancy hotel. Sherbert described it as a, quote, typical third-rate hotel, room small, meagerly furnished, iron bed, small dresser. According to Sherbert's notes, Doc retired from active circus life in 1917 and since that time had made his home in Portland. Quote, "Circus Day in Portland is a red-letter day in old Doc's calendar of events," Sherbert continued. "The big shows never forget him, and when they arrive in Portland, Doc is always presented with a generous supply of Annie Oakley's passes. Surrounding himself with a bunch of his cronies from the plaza blocks, Doc and his party are the first ones on the lot. And though a nonagenarian, Doc misses nothing that happens during the process of the performance and is alert to even the slightest deviation from conventional circus routine." Doc worked as a house painter when he came to Portland, but hard times came with the onset of the Depression, and at one point he found it necessary to live at the Multnomah County Poor Farm. With the passing of the Social Security Act, however, Doc was able to leave the county farm and move into the city. Sherbert described him as looking, quote, "younger than age claimed, with iron gray hair, oval face, dark complexion. Arthritis made it hard for the old gentleman to walk, but when he stepped out, he always wore his, quote, old-fashioned black derby hat with wide rolled brim." Here is his statement as passed on to us by Mr. Sherbert. "I was born in the little town of Kinderhook, New York, in 1847. My father was Dr. Thomas Van Alstyne, who later served as a surgeon in the Union Army during the Civil War. At an early age, I had a yearning for the show business. School didn't interest me a bit. I hated books. I wasn't a dang bit interested in reading about what somebody else did, where they went, what they saw. I wanted to go and do and see things for myself, and I couldn't think of any better way to satisfy my ambition than to join up with a circus. School in my day wasn't much like it is now. Boy, oh boy, in them days, if you didn't toe the line, you got what was coming to you. Teachers and parents both in them days had spare the rod, spoil the child ideas. If a youngster didn't do exactly what he was told, they used to lay it on plenty with a hickory switch or something just as good. Come a day once when I was a young gaffer in my early teens, I had a chance to run away with the mighty Yankee Robinson Circus. The lure of sawdust and spangles was much stronger than family ties or the red schoolhouse, so off I goes. I was only with the circus 4 days when I was dragged home to the family fireside and my place at the table, but not without a trip to the barn first, where my father strapped me around the legs and across the back with a tie strap, till I wasn't hardly able to navigate. As tough a licking as the old man gave out, I soon forgot it. But I didn't ever forget my first 4 days with the circus. The thrill of them days with Robinson's circus stuck with me through more than half a century of circus trooping. I was hired as a block boy. The block boy had to help set up and strike, tear down, the blues, cheap seat bleachers. Incidentally, general admission circus seats has been blue for as far back as I can remember. There wasn't no commoner job on the circus, but I remember how proud and thrilled I was merely to touch a piece of circus equipment. The blocks, the angle pieces, the seat boards, anything that was part of the circus. And I remember how I gazed in awe at the performers, and to think I was so close to them. I've seen a lot of beautiful women in my day, but I don't believe I ever seen a woman in my later life that looked so beautiful to me as them circus women did. I had the feeling they were queens or goddesses or something too beautiful to belong to this world. And I recall the thrill of thrills when a clown, circus folks call the funny man Joey's, said, "Hey lad, run to a butcher shop and get me a pound of lard." The Joeys used lard for taking off their clown white or makeup. I was so excited at having a performer actually speak to me that I couldn't say yes or no, but with the 10-cent piece he gave me clutched tight in my fist, I run like lightning to the nearest butcher shop. Boy, oh boy, was I happy. I will remember when I goes back to school after my 4 days with the circus. I cut quite a figure among the handful of bumpkins that was my schoolmates. Being with a circus made me a hero among them youngsters, and did I glory in it. I knew I'd have to stay in school a while longer. I couldn't help myself, but in the back of my head, I knew when I got a little bit older, I was going to join up with a circus and be a showman for always and always. My family was determined that I was going to be a doctor, just like my old man was. They insisted that I take up the study of medicine and follow in my father's footsteps. In them days, anybody that thought they was cut out for it could be a doctor if they wanted to. All you needed was a little schooling and be handy around sick folks and not be afraid of the sight of blood. All medicine was bitter if it was any good, and if they didn't know what ailed a person, they cupped him and drew some blood. Then he either got better or worse, as God willed. I might have made a good doctor at that if I could only get the show business off my mind. When I got a few years older, I was able to out-talk the old folks and get my own way. I gave up all thought of pill rolling and left home to join a circus, and I stuck with circuses for nearly 60 years of my life. Studying for a doctor, though, gave me the nickname Doc, and wherever on this globe the gray dawn sees a big top being raised, that's the name I'm knowed by. I've been asked to draw a comparison between the circus of today and the circuses of the past. Well, they just ain't no comparison. The circus in this day and age seems really to be the stupendous, gigantic, colossal exhibition that the advanced billing and the barkers and spielers and grinders claim for it. The old-time circus was a puny forerunner of the mammoth aggregations now on the road. The circus your grandfather went to see as a boy was nothing more than a variety or vaudeville show under canvas. Pretty near all the acts done in the circus could have been put in even the ordinary theaters of the time. Could you imagine a Ringling Brothers B&B show of today trying to squeeze into any theater or auditorium or indoor arena in any town, say like Portland? The people who works for circuses today is all trained specialists. Everybody has only one job, and he's supposed to do that one thing well. The old-time trooper was a jack of all trades. He could shoe a horse if he had to. He could clown, drive a 10-horse team, lay canvas, fill in anything around the lot except maybe aerial acrobatics, and believe it or not, many of the old-timers could even double in acrobatics. The circus has always been one of the world's most progressive enterprises. New inventions, if there was something the circus could use, was grabbed up by the circus as soon as they come out. The circus was always way ahead of anybody else in lighting equipment. When stores and business places throughout the country was still using tallow dips for light, the circus was using calcium flares bright enough to almost blind you. The pressure gas lights used by circus in the early part of this century was intensely brilliant, by contrast with the dim, dinky lights of the average town that the circus visited. Many small-town old-timers will tell you they first saw Edison's marvelous incandescent bulbs when some circus come to town. Yes, the circus of today is bigger and better in every way than circuses was, even 25 years ago. But the kids of today ain't so wide-eyed and amazed at what they see in a circus as they was a quarter century ago. So many marvelous things goes on all the time in this day and age that kids probably expect more from a circus now than it's humanly possible to give. In my more than a half century with circuses, I worked on all the big shows one time or another. The circuses took me to the far corners of both hemispheres, as give me many exciting experiences. I seen circuses miraculously missed by cyclones in the prairie states. When you're standing in the middle of a couple million dollars worth of circus equipment, it's always a thrill to see a blackish-greenish cloud with its trailing, death-dealing funnel bearing down on your show. The stock in the animal top, that's the menagerie tent, knows a storm is coming the same as you do. Makes you feel kind of funny in the pit of your stomach to hear them snarl and howl and whine and bellow and roar. As the storm gets nearer, they get nervous, testy, mean. It adds to the confusion on the lot. I was with a show in Hutchinson, Kansas once when a twister didn't miss. As the twister's whirling funnel comes toward us, all hands got busy and began grouping all the loose and movable equipment and gear and lashing everything together with tie ropes and tie chains. The animal wagons was hastily covered. We drops all canvas flat to the ground and strikes all poles. We didn't have much warning. A few seconds later, the twister was upon us and cutting a swath right through the center of the lot. We was what you would call lucky, though, because nobody got seriously hurt and we didn't lose no stock. But the big top was picked up and torn to shreds, and small parts of it were scattered all over the surrounding country. Train wrecks is another thing. I've been through many small wrecks in the course of years of trooping, and I was also in one big disastrous crack-up. The railroads in the old days didn't have no block signal systems like they got now, and as circus trains were always extras and not regularly scheduled trains, wrecks was frequent. At Gary, Indiana, I was with Sells Floto Circus. We had a wreck where over 100 persons were killed and a lot of valuable stock was lost. A hay rube is practically unknown today. A hay rube was a fight between the circus folks and the town yokels. These ruckuses used to come regularly every so often in the old days. Many of the hay rubes was started by folks figuring they wasn't getting all the circus advertised. If the stupendous wasn't stupendous enough, the gigantic wasn't gigantic enough, the colossal wasn't colossal enough, or the largest in captivity wasn't large enough. The town folks felt like they had grounds for a fight. Another common cause of hay rubes was because petty thieves and purse snatchers and pickpockets followed circuses from town to town. The circus got blamed for what them slickers did. There was nothing they could do about it. When the crooks hit a crowd too hard and too many people got plucked, the town folk got together and tried to take it out on the circus people. Pretty near every hay rube I ever seen ended with the town folks coming out second best physically, although the circus usually lost out financially. Lawsuits always followed a hay rube, and circus people had no chance for a square deal in a prejudiced small town court. I was in a hay rube in Lincoln, Illinois once. It was one of the toughest battles I ever seen. The town boys was coal miners and some of the toughest customers I ever seen. We strung out in a circle around our stuff and stood them off with laying out pins and whacked them with side poles, finally getting them on the run, but they sure could take it. Another hay rube in Ann Arbor, Michigan was started by a gang of students from the University of Michigan for no good reason at all, except maybe they thought it was funny. It cost the circus I was with more than $35,000 in lawsuits and damage to equipment. In a hay rube, most of the lawsuits that follow are usually from some innocent bystander who gets hurt in a scramble. The circus owners, you name them, I worked for them. They were all big men of fine character. Every one of the big circus owners was a square-shooting, two-fisted boss and not a sissy among them. I knowed the Ringling family well, seven boys and their father, Gus Ringling. Gus Ringling was a harness maker and teamster before he went into the circus business. Gus wasn't ever able to hire a better teamster on his show than he was himself. Old Gus could handle a 12-horse team so slick that the string of horses would form a perfect circle and the lead team could eat oats from the back of the wagon Gus was sitting in. Circus people in the old days was considered social outcasts. Decent people wouldn't have nothing to do with troopers. The attitude on the part of outsiders towards show folks brought the show folks closer together, made them clannish. Circus people was just one big family and was always a good lot, always willing to help each other over the bumps. People don't look at it the way they used to anymore, but circus people is still clannish just the same. Modern methods and high specialization has made it a lot easier for the circus man. Transportation has improved and accommodations is a lot better than they was. You don't have to be tough inside and out to troop with the circus nowadays. In the old days, any handler of circus stock knowed how to mix up a batch of kerosene or paregoric liniment to dope an ailing animal. Nowadays, the big show troops have a staff of veterinarians, and each valuable animal is watched as close and its diet figured out as carefully as for the Dion Quints. Dion Quints, by the way, are the first quintuplets to survive infancy, five girls born to the Dion family of Ontario in 1934. I got a lot of respect for Clyde Beatty and the other of today's animal trainers, but I don't think there is any comparison between the temper and ferocity of jungle-born cats that the old-time trainer faced twice a day and the animals born in captivity that the present-day trainers work with. You don't hardly ever hear of a trainer getting killed in an exhibition cage today. In the old days, I have seen trainers torn to ribbons in the twinkling of an eye. The circus reached its greatest size in 1908. After that year, they never got any bigger. In 1908, Ringling Brothers introduced the first speck, or spectacle. Since that year, the speck was a feature with all circuses. The first speck was called King Solomon. Later specks were Darber at Delhi, Arabian Nights, and others. I was boss canvas man for many years with a number of different circuses. Boss canvas man is a good job on a big show and pays from $75 to $100 a week. I made quite a lot of money in my day, but I haven't got anything to show for it now. As boss canvas man, I seen the sun rise in every town of importance in the United States. Most of my real old-time friends of the circus have passed through the connection to the other side. The connection, by the way, is the opening and runway through which the performers and animals enter the big top during a performance. By this doc meant his friends were mostly dead. Portland, Oregon has always had the name of being a good show town. I visited Portland with big shows many times before I quit the show business. I quit the show business 20 years ago, came to Portland to live. I figured I was getting too old to be gallivanting all over the country. Since then, I've made a living as a house painter, and I'm now the oldest active painter at the Painters Union at Portland. Yes, I learned to paint while I was in the show business. Many a piece of show equipment and wagons and platforms, etc., I painted for the circus. The show business may be a hard life, but if I had to do it all over again, I would still want you to give me the same route. It's been a long haul. I've passed the 90th flare, and I feel like I'm standing outside the connection waiting for the whistle. I better translate that last paragraph. A long haul, or a long haul town, is a town in which the railroad loading spur is situated a long distance from the circus lot. Flares are kerosene torches set out along the way from the loading spur to the lot to guide the teamsters, and flares are usually placed two to a block. 90 flares would indicate a long haul. In other words, old Doc is past the 90th milestone and feels like he hasn't much further to go. Standing outside the connection waiting for the whistle, performance acts and animals and stuff stand outside the connecting entrance to the arena for a short time before they're summoned to enter by the shrill note of the routine director's whistle. That's our show for today. This show is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. In addition to this podcast, it includes a weekly newspaper column, a daily RSS feed to catch on your smartphone news reader, a Facebook page, a Twitter feed, and a couple other minor components, all accessible through our anchor page at offbeatoregon.com. Photographs and other images that go with today's show are also on offbeatoregon.com, and while you're there, you can browse through more than 200 other articles written over the last 5 years, all organized by the date of publication. This podcast recording is covered under a Creative Commons license, but Stories, Legends, and Lies of Oregon are always readings from either public domain resources or copyrighted sources that are used by permission. For specifics about the copyright status of source materials, look this article up on offbeatoregon.com/lies. And for details about the Creative Commons license, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, and was written by Carmen Ficarra. I do Offbeat Oregon for learning and for fun, so I don't sell advertising and I don't ask for donations, but if you feel a need to make a donation anyway, may I suggest that you buy a copy of my book instead? It's called Wicked Portland, The Wild and Lusty Underworld of a Frontier Seaport Town. It's published by the History Press in 2012. It's sold through the usual channels, or you can order a signed copy from the store link at offbeatoregon.com if you like. But if you still have a local community bookstore in your town, I hope you'll consider buying it from them instead. Sells for $20. Well, 1999, but whatever. Finally, if you're ever in Corvallis, do drop me a line. Maybe we can grab a cup of coffee and talk history. I'm at finn@offbeatorgan.com. Don't be a stranger. Well, since tomorrow's Friday, a brand new show will be coming your way at around 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'm really looking forward to sharing it with you. Until then, go fill up the rest of today with good stuff. Bye now.